This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
We drilled to the bottom of the ocean, and we don't know what came out.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we're looking at a really cool horror film from the start of last year, Underwater, which snuck in right before the pandemic hit.
And it's still bombed.
Yeah, it did really bad.
We'll go over some news first. We've got some really horrifying news, we'll go over our thoughts of the movie. I think Adam and Dave have got a bit of a debate over the film's Lovecraftian themes, or lack thereof, if you're Adam. Then we've got a really cool interview with a deep sea marine biologist, as well, talking about some of the issues that this movie raises. And then Dave has a laundry list of physiological oddities, to go through with this movie as well. As always, like I said, we'll break the show up into those segments. There'll be some time codes below. So if there's something you'd like to listen to, you can skip ahead. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater/invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Dr. Adam Harsick, a parasite/disease ecologist, formerly the University of Arkansas.
Still, technically.
Alongside Adam is Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as every week, we're joined by Dave, a movie physiologist and practicing veterinarian. News this week, we have... So, whenever we talk about, you know, dangerous animals, we might think of, you know, big, massive predators like we had last week, the wolves, or, you know, horrifying little venomous creatures in Australia. But it's worth noting that you can get really fucked up by some of nature's smaller, more innocent-looking creatures. Case in point, at Craniatology on Twitter. Named Stephanie, but she's a fantastic mammal ecologist. And she was bitten this week by a squirrel. Might seem fairly harmless, but the bite got infected and she's ended up almost losing a finger. And essentially a whole arm swelled up. But anyway, yeah, so it's horrifying because apparently, Dave, you might be able to tell us more about this, but apparently she's a germ carrier that like 1 in 3 people have. And if you get bitten, this can like transfer the germ into your bloodstream and then wind up an infection.
Yeah, my understanding from looking over, it just has to do with her. Basically, everybody has commensal organisms. So a community of organisms that live on top of your skin and really aren't that much of a serious concern. But they're the main reason that we get secondary infections, secondary to chronic things like allergies, which Sam is currently experiencing. It's a sort of constant debate when we have dogs that come in. The most common cause of recurrent ear infections in dogs is actually skin allergies, where the skin becomes inflamed and irritated, and then secondary organisms that live on the skin become what are called opportunistic infections. So basically they're like, ooh, the skin is weak, and they get inside. Kind of like people climbing inside your fortress through a weakened area in the wall. And my understanding from reading this over was that she is one of those humans that just happens to carry a fairly resistant strain of bacteria naturally on her skin.
Mm.
And as a result, in situations where there's enough trauma, there's enough swelling, there's enough damage, that organism is given the ability to start to grow. And since many of them are resistant, and we are seeing a rise in antibiotic resistance across the entire planet right now, we get stuck with these organisms where we have to resort back to old methods of basically amputation or at least extreme tissue removal. Just because we don't, it used to just be, we'd be like, oh, okay, we'll give you an antibiotic.
Bring it back real quick to what Dave said about a commensal organism, which is relevant for today's episode. That is an organism that lives on or inside of another one without providing any benefit, but also not having any kind of cost to the, quote, host organism.
Yeah, but they derive a benefit from it.
Correct. They benefit, but the host does not.
So there's a benefit for one of them. Yeah. It's quite rare, right? Like, compared to mutualisms or antagonisms, I find commensalisms are quite hard to find, right?
It's probably a lot more prevalent than we think. We just don't study it too much.
We have lots of creatures that live on top of us that don't necessarily do anything, that only become a problem when we're damaged.
Yeah. But she had a bunch of people calling her up mansplaining, saying, well, are you sure it wasn't a snake? I've just never seen, you know, a squirrel do that kind of. Yeah. Very frustrating. But what she did post, which was really funny, was just a photo of a squirrel skull. Like, yeah, this can fuck you up. Look at those teeth.
It's a rodent. They're full of viruses and bacteria and sharp teeth.
Yeah. I got bit on the ear by my guinea pig the other day. Hurt like a motherfucker. I catapulted that little cunt across the room. No, I didn't. That would kill her instantly. I did not do that. Anyway, all the best to Stephanie at Craniotology. If you want to follow her for more of the story, you should find her on Twitter. I hope everything goes well for her.
Yeah, same.
All right, Morty, pack your shit. That's only going to keep him down for a little bit, Morty. You f***ed with squirrels, Morty. We got a good 5 minutes before they're backing up on our ass, Morty. We have to pack up and move to a new reality, Morty. You know, I said we can only do that a couple of times. We're f***ed over here because of these damn squirrels, Morty.
So, today's movie. Dave, do you want to do a summary?
Yeah.
I'd let Adam do a summary, but I feel like he's going to start screaming about H.P. Lovecraft halfway through.
He would start off with that.
Yeah, I stumbled on this film in terms of, like, I really wasn't interested in seeing it and did not see it when it released, but it was only, because Sam, I messaged you about it a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
Where it popped up in, like, one of, like, the monster blogs I follow, and they were like, this is actually a really good film. I think you'd enjoy it. And then I ended up convincing my partner to watch it. So the film fantastically just opens right in the middle of the fray with one of the shortest introductions, which I absolutely loved. Basically, there's a deep sea device that's been lowered for drilling purposes to the bottom of Mariana's Trench. We start following a mechanical engineer who finds herself in the middle of catastrophic failure associated with the rig, as they call it, where basically it starts to collapse, forcing her to seek shelter and basically in the center of the rig with a group of other employees. They then decide since the escape pods are broken, they need to try and make a daring escape to one of the other drilling stations that's separate from the primary rig, where they can try to make their ascent towards the surface. During that process, they encounter a creature and set of creatures that seem to be existing outside of the ship and seem to be responsible for the catastrophic failure of the rig, which are their origin are loosely based on the stories of H.P. Lovecraft in relation to the Deep Ones and Cthulhu, which we'll be getting into later today.
Yeah, so, I mean, we already say S for spoilers, but the director has come out and said, yes, this is meant to be Cthulhu. And the Deep Ones, was it?
Yeah, it's the Deep Ones.
Deep Ones, okay, yeah. Which is, I maybe should we let Adam unload now?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, so...
Well, Adam, you can just go into what they are in terms of the H.P. Lovecraft.
So H.P. Lovecraft, late 19th, early 20th century author, never really famous in his time, but has kind of developed quite a following in the modern times as one of the pioneers of horror fiction, specifically cosmic horror. And cosmic horror is a branch of horror that is all about the undefinable, the unknowable, and often like forbidden knowledge type stuff. So you think about this thing from far beyond the stars that the human mind cannot even grasp, and it's so horrifying, even looking at it can drive you insane. So that's what cosmic horror or Lovecraftian horror is supposed to be. The director has said this is Lovecraftian horror. He has said that it's Cthulhu. I heavily disagree with all of that. Nothing about this is cosmic horror. This is like saying Star Wars is inspired by or is the same as Star Trek because they both take place in space. Like, cool, this monster has some tentacles on its face. It's not Cthulhu. And these are not Deep Ones. I take a extreme amount of issue with that. A Deep One is like a fish person. Think of Abe Sapien from Hellboy.
Exactly.
That's what a Deep One is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, surely you can't begrudge him for putting his own spin on something.
No. And I actually enjoyed him bringing in, and particularly associated with Cthulhu is found in the bottom of the ocean in the very first appearance, Call of Cthulhu. That's where he's located. He's been imprisoned in the deep. And I mean, just to focus, these two creatures are based on, so the Deep Ones that come from the H.P. Lovecraftian, the shadow over Innsmouth, which are basically these humanoid beings, kind of fish-like with amphibian traits, that live on the bottom of the ocean. We actually only ever get to see in the book one of their cities, which is sort of based near Innsmouth. And the way that they come about in that sort of horror setting in the book is that they basically made a deal with the locals of the city that allows them to get sacrifices as well as interbreeding, where they create versions of themselves, which will eventually, as they start to strike middle age, evolve into the deep ones and then return to the sea, where they'll gain the normal properties of the deep ones, which is immortality. The deep ones worship three sort of separate gods. So the father dragon, mother Hydra, as well as they have a deep worship for Cthulhu, which is sort of where the connection comes here.
So Adam put me onto the Shadow of Innsmouth, which I read yesterday, and I did not hate it. Because, so, full disclosure, I'm not a huge fan of cosmic horror. I read the Annihilation trilogy and Thomas Ligotti. Have you guys heard of Thomas Ligotti?
No.
I've heard the name.
He's like, yeah, he's a contemporary cosmic or more, I think he's called more obscure horror. Like, it's very much that sense of the unknowable, but not from beyond the stars, like on this planet. And I fucking hated it. But Shadow Over Innsmouth, I did not mind. That was, you know, not too bad. And I saw throughout, like, I was just like, okay, I can see that he's taken it from a New England setting to a more modern kind of horrifying setting, but what do you really? Because I've heard that a lot of H.P. Lovecraft stories are centered around, you know, dreary New England towns. Surely this is like a more interesting setting than that. I mean, I do not want to go back to fucking Maine.
Yeah.
The setting is definitely interesting and it's cool because it's like alien underwater in a lot of ways, because all of the set pieces look very much like the Nostromo from the first Alien movie. But the thing with the setting of these Lovecraftian or cosmic horror stories is that there's this creeping sense of dread and this deep, deep, disturbing sense of something being wrong. And that's something that is the protagonist or the narrator in The Shadow Over Innsmouth is like realizing as he's in Innsmouth, like people don't quite look right. Everything seems kind of sickly. Mm-hmm. People look fishy in a way. Nothing about this movie was to me like creeping or disturbing. It was like, it was kind of tense because they're at the bottom of the ocean, but I never, ever felt this sense of dread.
You don't think things looked fishy?
Yeah.
No.
So just to sort of cut that off for anyone who hasn't seen the film, during the movie itself, as they're exploring underwater, they come in contact with these large humanoid creatures, similar to the deep ones that we're discussing, that are quite tall, large webbed feet, fast moving. And then eventually we find out that they're all arising from a central, gigantic, tentacled creature, which is sort of loosely implied to be Cthulhu.
It looks like a kaiju from Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
But again, the director has come out and said, it is Cthulhu. Right. And Cthulhu's in the public domain, so it is. You know, nobody can stop him.
People can take their own takes.
Well, yes. I think the thing for me is that when you write a genre, you touch on certain themes of that genre. So with cosmic horror, as Adam already said, you do have that existential dread. You have the discovery or accidental discovery of the unknown and incomprehensible. But I think also with Lovecraftian horror, it tends to really dive into the madness. And I think while this, I've kind of a mix between Adam and Dave's opinion. I think that this movie definitely had Lovecraftian inspiration, but it would be, I would be hard pressed to say that it has themes just because it doesn't touch on too many of the cosmic horror, general themes. I think movies like The Mist, The Thing, we talked about that 2 weeks ago, where you have characters that are driven insane by that unknown, by the dread, and do crazy things in response to just straight up freaking out. And you don't really get that. Yeah. Everyone kind of is definitely like unnerved, but they're
just reasonable.
Trying to survive. Yeah, right. They're reasonable. Yeah.
And the key idea that H.P. Lovecraft even said about his stories was the helplessness of man. The sort of central theme that associated is that man is not able to fight back or take steps against these creatures. You're trapped in a situation, and it doesn't feel like any of them exhibit a great degree of helplessness in this film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They definitely fight back.
I think they could have, again, I'm not a huge Lovecraft fan. He sounds like a fucking horrible man. But
racist.
Racist piece of shit.
Mass.
Super racist.
And it gets
the archetype, though, for why people are racist. Like, never went outside of his home, never actually met anybody from any of the races he hated. I think they could have solved a lot of this by, having a bigger sense of, like, uncertainty as to whether there are actually creatures out there or just these crew members are seeing things because they're losing it. And also, I think it loses a bit of that Lovecraftian sense of helplessness by the fact that Kristen Stewart is implied to have killed it at the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, potentially. I mean, the...
And all the characters are very capable.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know. I kind of like that we didn't fall into that old trope of...
Someone being a dick.
Yeah, like that whole trope of people doing dumb things, like in the Prometheus film and that sort of shit. Like, you just had people who were working together to try and survive. Having said that, as Libby pointed out, does kind of detract from the whole Lovecraftian sense of it all.
I don't think the director has ever said he was trying to create a film with cosmic horror. I think he said that, like, it's Cthulhu, the monsters are inspired by his take on them, and I would wholeheartedly agree with Adam. This is not Cthulhu in terms of what it is, but I do love that clearly he's got a passion for these creatures, and he was like, oh, I want to incorporate them into my movie in these strange, creepy ways. And I do really find the interpretation of the Deep Ones creepy. When they're moving around in the water and you can barely catch them in the flashlight as they kind of zoom from area to area. When it's crawling across the metal deck at one point, getting closer to her as it keeps popping up.
Yeah.
I definitely was in a boat of like, oh, well, you're fucked. You've got nothing. Get this.
Yeah. That was by far my favorite scene when they do finally the big introduction and the big full body reveal. I thought that was fantastic. Yeah. And I don't know, I think that this is obviously, like you said, his own take on Cthulhu, and I think if this brings more people into the Lovecraftian mythos, it can be okay. It's one of the reasons why I don't think The Watch is a particularly good interpretation of Terry Pratchett's books.
Mm.
But if certain people like it and it brings more people into reading those books, I think it's a step forward. It's hard because, it's not directly said that this is, Lovecraft or Cthulhu. You kind of have to go and look it up. So whether it will actually bring more fans into reading that sort of stuff is, it's tricky.
Well, I'll say, too, there was way more Alice in Wonderland references and themes.
Bunny,
than Cthulhu.
Big time.
Yeah. I like that that they gave... So TJ Miller's in this, which is weird seeing him back in things, by the way.
He's great in this, though.
He was really good.
Yeah, and... Apparently, they would switch in every now and then. They would give him a live rabbit instead of the toy rabbit that he carries around to, like, make him, like, really care for the toy rabbit when he had it. Apparently, there's, like, maybe it was that article you sent through, Adam, which mentioned that there's one shot in the film, where it's actually a live rabbit. You have to really pay attention, but,
Didn't they tell him that it was a real rabbit the whole time?
Yeah, they told him it was going to be a real rabbit the entire movie, so you really need to treat this, but, like, we're going to CGI a real rabbit in, so, like, treat this stuffed rabbit like it's real. So, I mean, like, as if you watch the movie... He's very, very concerned about this stuffed rabbit the entire time, like a crazy person would be. Yeah. Like, caring for it, talking to it, handing it to... Like, when we first see TJ Miller's character, he's trapped under rubble. They're able to move the rubble, and the first thing he does is shove this fake rabbit through the hole and be like, take him, take him.
Right, and it's the first thing he does when the creature is getting him, right? He passes
the
rabbit off, and he's just like, no, take the bunny, take the bunny.
But, Adam, because Dave and I, like... I think we've put forth that we actually enjoyed this film. Libby, I think you said you were halfway between Adam and Dave. Adam, did you like this movie, though?
I really enjoyed this movie. I just took an extreme amount of issue with him calling it Lovecraftian and Cthulhu. Like I said, and I've said it before, but it stands out to me so much of like, well, this, so The Phantom Menace, this Star Wars movie I made, this is directly inspired by, and this is Star Trek because I like Star Trek, and I'm saying this is Star Trek.
Mm,
they're
okay.
Two completely different things.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this movie, too, for the record. I think for me, it felt more like a modernization of Alien. Like, it seemed like the 2020-2021 Alien.
Yep.
It took a lot of shit for people who were like, oh, well, it takes heavily
Alien
from
underwater.
The Alien movies. And I was like, why is that a bad thing?
I know.
That amazing movie?
That movie that everyone loves.
Right? Like, oh, this is a shitty movie. It's basically Jedis fighting underground. I'd be like, I want to see mining Jedis. Can
Sweet.
I see mining Jedis?
Well, and I think there's a thing between, like, recreating an old movie, like, step by step. Because those are boring, right? Like, it's just essentially, like, Star Wars, right?
Yeah, it was Force
just
Awakens and
Force
a New Hope.
Awakens. It was just Star Wars over again. But this one is, like, it definitely feels like Alien, but it's different. Like, there's... Yeah. different things happen. You know, it's obviously a very, very different setting. It just gives you that feel and that sort of...
Adam, Libby, yeah. and I have already nerded out about this, but I fucking love those underwater suits.
So fucking cool.
They put them on and they light up and they're just so cool looking. And I was just like, that is just awesome.
We're all going to be that for Halloween.
There's that scene early on, which really, like, for anybody who doesn't know anything about deep sea life, it really sets the tone for them when that guy just implodes in a second because his suit developed cracks. Great scene, by the way, because it's implied that he knew the suit was fucked up and he didn't let Kristen Stewart take it, which was a really, you know, I thought that guy was going to be the dick, like the really annoying character who's, you know, screaming out like Bill Paxton in Aliens. But his death is like gruesome. Like it's just this implosion in like a second and there's just chunks of him floating around in the water. It's a really, like, and the fact that this movie, like they said earlier, it just starts, like, I think you get a minute with Kristen Stewart's character,
and then
everything goes to shit.
Which apparently is one of the reasons she said she signed up for the film.
Speaking of Kristen Stewart's character, I do need to come up with a new award system for the podcast called the Janie. Inspired by Thomas Jane from Deep Blue Sea, flip-flopping around and sliding for no fucking reason. I have to give Kristen Stewart and Jessica Henwick a Janie for this movie because in the first 2 minutes, I think Kristen Stewart flops 4 times and Jessica Henwick does at least 3 times throughout the movie for no reason.
Definitely earn their Janies.
I would have put Adam in like a half-submerged like shipping crate one day and just make him do laps back and forth and like prod him with an electric poker every 20 seconds and see how he deals with it. Yeah, I was just going to say that I always go into Kristen Stewart films really wanting to like them, because whilst I hated her and Shovel Face when they first did the Twilight movies, I felt bad for them by the end of it, because they clearly realized that they'd fucked up. And, like, when you're young and somebody's like, hey, we're going to give you a movie franchise, you're going to be seen by, you know, billions of screaming fans all over the world. Millions of screaming fans. Billions is probably an estimate. Millions of screaming fans and some horny mums all over the world, and we're going to give you, you know, millions of dollars. Yeah, you're going to go for it. And then they grew older and they realized, oh, this may have tainted my career. So I really want them to make good films and do well. And Robert Pattinson has already really eschewed that. But Kristen Stewart's, I think, had a harder time of it.
She's done some good stuff.
Yeah, but people still see her and they're like, oh, that Twilight girl. Whereas Robert Pattinson's now Batman.
She also got herself stuck under a lot of the things that various female celebrities have talked about, which is sort of going through the teenage years where you make mistakes and problems, and the guys who are involved in the same issue, it just gets completely wiped away. And the women find themselves in these situations where, perfect example, Justin Timberlake gets to walk around and they're like, oh yeah, like he's fine, he's great, he's grown up, he's so wonderful. And we find situations where Britney Spears, during every interview, they're like, so how do you feel about breaking Justin's heart? And Kristen Stewart has said that it took her a very long time, and she's still working on getting out of a lot of the weight of everything that happened during her younger years, basically being blown up on film every time that she goes in for an interview.
Did your Twilight experience turn out to be what you expected?
If Edward was not a fictional character and you just met him in reality, you know, he's one of those guys who'd be like an axe murderer.
So, before we start getting into the science of this movie, if you've got any thoughts, comments, questions, if you've got your own take on what Lovecraft is, then why Adam is not a proper Lovecraft fan and he doesn't know Lovecraft, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hasik Adam, H-A-S-I-K Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, www.cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, visit www.shortstorysoup.substack.com, and you can sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about some of the more regular ecology that Adam and I write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. On there, you'll also find some articles from our guest this week, who we'll introduce shortly. Eva Paulus, from the University of Konstanz in southern Germany. She's a marine biologist, deep sea marine biologist, who will get into a bit of her work soon. And if you want kind of an overview of what she looks at, you can check out the article that she wrote on Ecology for the Masses called Venturing into the Earth's Great Unknown, the Mesopelagic Zone. And if you want to find Eva on Twitter, you can find her at deep_c_derndl. Yeah, so as this... this episode deals with events that happened at the bottom of the sea, and I'm very much a freshwater biologist, and a freshwater lake is a nice place, but it's not the bottom of the sea. We thought we'd get somebody on board, and like I said, I contacted Eva, who writes for Ecology for the Masses, and we had a really interesting interview with her about what life is like at the bottom of the sea, some of the adaptations creatures have for that, and also why deep sea mining, which these people are carrying out in this film, is really bad for, you know, deep sea life and deep sea biodiversity.
Tom, the DP Oil Company has had another drilling accident. This time they appeared to have unleashed the dark and mighty Cthulhu. The rise of Cthulhu from another dimension brings about 3,000 years of darkness, Tom, where we will all be driven to madness and made to serve as Cthulhu's cultist slaves.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Like we said, we're going to have a kind of aside this week to talk a little bit more about like deep sea marine biodiversity and some of the adaptations that creatures have down there. So I have enrolled a fellow Ecology for the Masses writer, Eva Polis, who is a newly minted PhD student at the University of Konstanz in southern Germany. And you did your master's in marine ecology at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, right?
Yeah, in marine biology, exactly.
Okay, do you want to tell us a little bit about what your PhD is going to focus on?
Yes, so my PhD is going to be about these deep sea fish that live between 200 and 1,000 meters depth. And they're the ones that you commonly think of when you think of deep sea fish. They are like the creepy ones. Yeah, with really big teeth and stomachs that can, you know, take up a whole huge fish and so on. So I'm going to look at them genetically, but also morphologically. So comparing how well connected the populations are or how well their necks can stretch to take up prey or something like that.
Okay, cool. And you recently had your first single author paper published, right? About deep sea biodiversity?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's about just in general deep sea biodiversity, what we know about it, what we don't know about it, what the methods are that we are currently using to study deep sea biodiversity. But the fish that got me into the whole deep sea biology scene is the viperfish. And when they first found that one, nobody believed the guy that it was an actual fish. They just thought he stitched together some random body parts of other fish. And then it took a couple decades for someone to officially describe this fish as the actual fish it was. And also, at first, people thought that in the deep sea there wasn't really any life. So there was one expedition where they kind of were like, yeah, probably after a few hundred meters, there's no life at all. And then later on, you know, someone else went on an expedition and they realized, oh my God, it actually starts to get good, you know, on the ocean floor.
Sounds like kind of ultimate hipster thing. It's just like, well, I'm into deep sea fishes, you know, I don't know if you've heard of them before.
Yeah.
Cool. So, obviously, for a movie like this, I'm not sure if you've seen Underwater, but it focuses on incredibly voracious predators at the bottom of the ocean. Now, the first question that kind of popped into my mind when I was looking at this is there enough life down there and how would life down there evolve? But your response to this question was straight away like, well, why wouldn't there be life down there?
Yeah. So, I think there's a different hypotheses on where life evolved, but some of it is it's very possible that life evolved at these deep sea hydrothermal vents, right? Like the first life ever. So we are kind of the weird ones. All the animals living on land are really much weirder than all the deep sea animals. And I mean, there's also a lot of pressure on us. We just don't notice it. And it's the same for these deep sea animals, right? They don't know that they're not supposed to be living under this huge pressure. But of course, they also have adaptations, like their tissues are different and they don't have sinuses or lungs like we do. They don't have air cavities like we do.
Okay. What are some of the coolest adaptations for deep sea life that you've come across?
Yeah. So I think for my fish, probably that they have all this bioluminescence and that they can really see. They have these spots in their face that kind of light up just a certain thing. So if you've ever been like in the rainforest and you're trying to find a snake, you are shining a flashlight just at the trees and you see if there's a reflection. And for example, if you're looking for snakes or crocodiles or something, their eyes will reflect it, the flashlight. So this is what the deep sea fish do, and all the other predators as well. They are just trying to find something that reflects back, and that might be a prey item, or it might be a female of the species you're trying to mate with. So, okay.
So they're carrying around their own little series of underwater torches?
Yes, exactly.
Cool. Okay. This movie implies that there's a species down at the bottom of the ocean that has managed to maintain a reasonable population. They're about, you know, like twice the size of humans. Is there enough, like, abundance, enough biomass down there for them to feed on and sustain a population, do you think?
I think it depends on how deep it is. If we're talking, like, deeper than, like, 8,000 meters, there's not really going to be any fish. But if we're talking, like, below 200 meters, there's definitely a lot of fish. It's the biggest biomass of fish that you can imagine. They're just all around the world. There's a huge, just billions and billions of animals that every day migrate up and down. So when the sun sets, these animals come up to feed into the epipelagic, where there's light during the day and there's food, algae and whatever. And then when it becomes light again, they go back down. So there is just immeasurable amounts of animals that do live in the deep sea, but somewhere between 200 and 1,000 meters.
Okay.
But probably the deep sea mining is deeper than that.
Yeah.
And their life is a lot slower, and there's not as much biomass for sure. There's more worms and little crustaceans.
This movie is, yeah, bottom of the Mariana Trench, so potentially a little bit too far down.
Yeah. Definitely, there's not going to be a lot of fish.
Okay. So, if you had a species that could come up a little bit further, they might be able to subsist, but then you've got the pressure differential to worry about, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So, these species are very, in the movie, they're very heavily implied to have eyes, like eyes that, you know, operate in the same way ours do. Is that at all useful to a species operating at that sort of depth?
I would say at the Mariana Trench, at the bottom there. There's pretty much no light except from other animals. Like, there might be bioluminescence. So I think for that, they would be highly adapted to find animals that, you know, just emit the tiniest amount of light. So there's a squid that's called the cock-eyed squid, and it has two different kinds of eyes. Maybe you've seen it in the movie. Or in a documentary.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they have one really weird eye that's looking above, so it can detect animals that are swimming above it, and one that looks down below.
Oh, okay, cool.
And also, like, the fish that I'm studying, they have these photophores along their belly, mm-hmm. and they are trying to match the little light that is coming down there. So if they're swimming above something else, they're trying to really, through the bioluminescence, camouflage themselves.
Okay, cool. Okay, how big can deep sea life get to?
So, I mean, there's the colossal squid, yep. And they get really big.
Okay.
Like, a couple meters. But I don't think there's huge populations of those. Those are the things that the sperm whales eat, right? Yep. Like, where you often see on sperm whales, they have these huge marks on them that the squid make. But, yeah, so I think, I mean, it's definitely possible that there's large animals that still haven't really been found in the deep sea.
Okay.
But I don't think they're going to be any crazy new thing that we've never seen before. It's more that we have to really look at the details.
Yep.
And, yeah, just, I mean, you have to hope that something washes up that's never been seen before.
Yeah. So on that note, why is deep sea mining and exploitation such a huge problem?
Yeah. So I know quite a lot about the mining for metals. So there's these manganese nodules that have metals in them that have been built up naturally for millions and millions of years on the seabed. So the biggest operation here is in the Pacific, just out in the middle of the ocean. And different countries have already staked their claim, is that how you say that, to mine these manganese nodules in the future. And they're already, there's a Belgian company that is actually right now testing whether this is going to work. They built a prototype of the machine they want to use to scoop up these manganese nodules from the deep ocean floor. The problem is that there's going to be, it's going to really disrupt the environment there. So there's, this is like the only hard structures that are on the ocean floor. So anything like from octopus to sponges to any living creature really is using these manganese nodules to keep their eggs or as a habitat. And so if we're going to remove them, that also removes all the animals on it, but also it's going to generate these giant plumes of the sediment that has settled there for millions and millions of years. So we're going to, all the animals that are filter feeding, for example, are not going to be able to filter feed anymore for potentially, you know, hundreds or thousands of years, just because we're suspending the deep sea sediment again. So there's a lot of problems, but also a lot of money to be made from these.
Yeah, and if humans are, if nothing, animals that are a little bit greedy.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, cool. Well, look, that's all I kind of wanted to cover. Thank you very much, Eva, for coming on.
Yeah.
And yeah, good luck with the first few months of your PhD.
Thank you so much.
A shift to a world that's no longer powered by fossil fuels likely means we're going to rely more on batteries and the metals that make them. Because land-based sources of these metals can meet the demand of a battery-powered world, private companies have turned their attention to the ocean floor. But mining the murky depths may come with a greater cost to the planet than it's worth.
So yeah, basically, I think the takeaway message in terms of the science is these creatures would not be able to survive down there. There is nothing for them to eat.
Nope.
Yeah. Nope. It's just, I mean, if as we said, if they went a little further up, there's a massive amount of biomass of plant life, animal life, for them to feed on. But then the pressure differential comes into play, right? And Dave, I mean, you got really annoyed during Aquaman because you have this deep sea creature that comes up to the surface. But that's treated a lot better in this, right? Like, the pressure is very much like you have the thing where Vinnie Cassell, by the way, I love seeing Vinnie Cassell in a movie, gets dragged up and up and up and up and up and then explodes suddenly, right? Because the pressure differential is too big.
He implodes.
Isn't he dragged upwards? So wouldn't that make him...
He is, but the stress on the helmet breaks it, and then the pressure differential between his suit and the water, it's what crashes in and makes the implosion.
Okay, I misinterpreted that scene. I thought he was dragged up...
Yeah, all of them, that's why they keep exploding.
That's what that was. It was a cavitation bubble.
Yeah, because, I mean, they had one implosion. I was hoping for one explosion as well, just, you know.
I mean, technically, there should be both based on what's going on. So basically, yeah, whenever we get to see them crush, immediate pressure, the water sort of rushes into the space, ruptures the oxygen tanks. The oxygen tanks then basically explode, like the regulator, all the system sort of goes away. We get that initial push of oxygen that creates that initial explosion, and then the water rushes back into that space. There should be much bigger shock waves, but it's actually the first scene, like inside of the elevator, where like everybody just gets like blown outward, and there's like chunks of the guy like flying around everywhere. I was like, okay, that's actually pretty good.
So at the end of the film, Kristen Stewart manages to save Jessica Henwick and Jessica Henwick's husband or boyfriend. I cannot remember for the life of me who the
Smith.
Actor was.
Boyfriend.
But Smith, okay, yeah. Well, they're flying up towards the surface, and then she explodes the base because the deep ones are following them up, right? That's not a threat, right? Because, I mean, if they're adapted for the deep sea, as soon as they get up high enough,
no, Adam and I are both just shaking our heads no.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I think a really common example of like how decompression can really fuck you up is a lot of people know what the blobfish is and what that looks like. Yeah, and a lot of people don't know that that's not really what a blobfish looks like.
They look like a pretty normal fish. I mean, a very nondescript fish. Like, you know, you wouldn't want to introduce it to your parents. They'd probably think you were a sculpin. Yeah, a freshwater sculpin, because freshwater fish are always boring as fuck. But anything else? Because it's a pretty light episode for us this week, I feel, Adam. It's just that, yeah, they wouldn't be able to sustain a population, really.
Yeah, ecologically, I looked it up just because I wanted to be sure. There isn't a lot of life at the bottom of the ocean, especially in the Mariana Trench, specifically the Challenger Deep, which is the deepest point on the planet. Just about the biggest organism down there and the top predator is called the Mariana snailfish, which looks like a blobfish. Yeah. And it's about 11 inches or 28, 29 centimeters long. And that's about as big as things get down there. Yeah. So
Eva mentioned the colossal squid, but she's more talking about, you know, like the deep sea. She doesn't mean the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, that's it for us. But I think, Dave, you have a laundry list of things to go to.
And I mean, some of this was already sort of covered in the previous sort of deep sea discussion. Now, I had sort of written up all of that beforehand, so I'm kind of going to be going through things, but obviously we'll be deferring to the expertise from the marine biologist, and we'll be counting on Adam very heavily to sort of keep me in line here. So the first sort of thing that I was going to talk about, because a lot of the, obviously the survival at the bottom of the ocean, adaptations, but just quickly to go over sort of the biggest things for surviving along the bottom of the ocean that seem to be the common adaptations are you're working with low light, increased pressure, food is fairly rare.
Very rare.
There is generally low oxygen. And you oftentimes, there are very few other animals, including animals of your species, which makes breeding really complicated. Kind of like dating in Arkansas.
It's not that complicated when your family tree is a single branch.
Oh, Jesus Christ. So the things I wanted to focus on were more just like the different physiological structures that we kind of run into as we get exposure to these different species. So the first thing I wanted to focus on, because I thought it was one of the sort of coolest levels, is the eyes, right? Vision underwater is rather difficult, especially like down at the bottom of the ocean. And they've looked at a number of the different marine species that sort of exist at these lower depths to try and figure out, like, how do you see? How does that work? How are you making things get along? And the big things that they've found that they possess are really big eyeballs. They want to try to take in as much light as they can. Really large retinas, the structure we talked about last week that sits at the back of the eye and basically catches the light as it passes through. And a huge amount of a certain type of photoreceptors. So we've probably heard many discussions about cones versus rods in terms of like what picks up more. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, if you're ever trying to remember it for a biology lecture, cones are a more complicated shape, so they catch light. Rods are a simpler shape, so they just do your black and white. Hmm. And the eyes that have been like looked at from these deep sea organisms, almost exclusively made up of rods and just packed with rods, because they're just trying to pick up as little light as they possibly can. And most of them heavily rely on this because either they're communicating through bioluminescence or they're hunting organisms that are bioluminescent just at these like large depths. So when we first run into the deep ones, we see they have these fairly big eyes. They're not as big as I would expect that they probably would be.
Not big enough.
No. They do have a shine to them. Which, interestingly enough, the colossal squid and many other of these deep sea organisms, their tapetal lucidum, like the organism or the mechanism at the back of the eye, is actually so intense and sensitive that their eyes are known to glow at deep sea lengths because they're just trying to pick up as much. And that's apparently one of the features that you can use to identify a colossal squid if you're ever swimming deep in the water in the Arctic, I guess.
Or if it washes up on the beach, which they're known to do.
Yeah. You can see the changes, that their eyes basically glow underwater at the smallest amount of light, which is really cool.
And with the squid and eyeballs, the giant squid has, as far as eyeball size to body ratio, the giant squid has the largest eyeball on the planet. It's at least in our measurements, it's about 15 inches across, like 34 centimeters.
Yeah, exactly. 12 to 16 inches.
It's huge.
That's so cool. Yeah, in terms of that structure, the fact that we get first introduced to them and you see them jumping around and they've got those glowing eyes, I was like, that's actually really cool. I would see that happening, that they're going to be these super light sensitive organisms. And they are so incredibly drawn to anything generating light, which feeds into sort of that point of most likely we're expecting that if they are at the deep sea, anything that they can find that's casting any amount of light on it, whether or not it's a bioluminescence tracking mechanism or they are just fucking starving all the time, these guys are going to ravenously go after it.
Yes.
Now, the second thing I kind of wanted to talk about was their jaw structure, because we get integrated to the deep ones very early on when Kristen Stewart gets bit by one of them, and it basically tries to engulf her entire helmet. And on top of that, it's got this sort of external part of the jaw that seems to have teeth on it that latch onto her and then start basically like pulling her in. And at first, it looks like there's almost a tongue or a secondary mouth mechanism that comes out. So I had thoughts on that. But as the film goes on, she eventually does get eaten by one of them. It pulls her directly in, and then she has to flare gun her way out of it. Fantastic scene.
Like a snake.
Yes. Like a snake, or there's a whole bunch of deep sea organisms that actually have these mechanisms, where they pull you in. Squids obviously do not fall into that category. They've got the primary beak mechanism where basically they're crunching you up. But the fish-eating snail that we've talked about before is an example of something that does this. And jellyfish also pull in their prey mostly intact, in terms of they just have like a large oral opening where they kind of pull things in.
Also Adam when he's eating pizza.
Yes. Just pulling it in. Well, let's hope that Adam doesn't have this adaptation. So it makes sense. The mouth that extends out, that they're grabbing things, they could be taking on a deep sea mechanism for basically just pulling in material and then internally digesting it as much as they can. The thing is, almost all the species that do this have one thing in common between, you know, jellyfish, fish-eating snail, whatever they might be. You have to stun your prey. No one likes to have something inside of your stomach that's kicking and moving around. It will do damage to you, and in rare cases, apparently, it will fire a flare gun and climb its way out. The thing that they all have to have in common is they have to have some type of neurotoxin. So actually staring at those teeth when it's bringing them in, and even they have the scene where they're looking at the juvenile one that they've rescued, and it almost looks like there's something dripping off the little hooked tentacle that's on it.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect there probably is some type of, you know, whether or not it's mild or strong, some form of paralytic that these things are secreting. If they're going to eat like that, they're going to have to basically stun their prey, wrap them up, and then ingest them such that they're paralyzed, where you can start to begin the long digestive process. Now, generally speaking, Kristen Stewart would not be a good thing to eat, which I think is just a mistake on this poor creature's part. It pulls it in. It's probably used to either finding dead or decayed material, that basically detritus, something that's fallen from the upper levels, which a lot of the organisms...
Which I think it would have to be, because we see these things...
Yeah.
When we first get the reveal of Cthulhu, it like moves its tentacle, and you see these things kind of moving with it, because they're all roosting on it.
Yeah.
There are, I think, a commensal organism on the behemoth, because they call them clingers, they don't call them deep ones in the movie, at least the director does. And I think these are much like a remora on a shark. So a remora is a fish that has a sucker adaptation that sticks to a shark. And then whenever a shark eats something, there's like detritus in the water, the remora will detach, eat that detritus, and kind of like scavenge off of it. So I think that these clingers are scavengers off of whatever the behemoth eats.
Sure. And anything that's falling from the upper levels, animals that have died or decayed, or what little life they can otherwise find down there, where it's weak enough that they can basically just paralyze it and ingest it. And they're not going to be used to dealing with things covered in full steel-plated armor that's designed to protect you at the bottom of the ocean. So I'm not even sure Kristen Stewart was in that much danger. Watching it again, I worried she'd either be regurgitated or eventually she'd cause a blockade inside of this creature, and then it would potentially die. It'd be a much longer process to get her out. But I don't really think she was at any risk of actually getting digested.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Now, there would be different adaptations, right? The jaw that's found on lobsters and other creatures, The jaw that we're seeing of this grip on, pull things in, and then digest them, it's not really something that's found a lot in detritus eaters. I was trying to find examples. Most of the time, you've got a specialized set of mouth parts more similar to the lobster, where you're set to kind of grind things up and tear them, to shred them into pieces such that you can then pull that material in and then eat it.
And manipulate them.
Bottom feeders tend to have more unique kind of characteristics. The jaw on this thing would suggest that it's more actively hunting. Which, again, it's not quite at the right depth for that. I'd expect it to be further up if that was the case, if it was taking on. And we know that they have, you know, talons. And the colossal squid is an example of something with little hooked talons on it to grip its food to pull them in. Which, interestingly enough, we see on the juvenile organism, but we don't see on the full-grown deep ones. Like, they don't have tentacles coming
out. No, they don't appear to.
Yeah, and so that more of what this thing looks to be built for, I could maybe see it as a modified detritus eater of it's just running along at the bottom and grabbing everything that it can. But that is a recipe to pull in stuff that you really don't want to eat that's going to make you very sick going forward.
I mean, yeah, like you said, it's built more like a predator, and a good example of this is something like a lanternfish, which is, you can see in Finding Nemo, the part where they're in the dark and that fish has the light on it, or an anglerfish as well, or a viperfish, which is like a meaner looking one that is like all stomach and teeth. And basically these mouths of those fish, they have a ton of very sharp, very pointy, very long teeth that are just meant to catch anything they can. And their stomach can balloon out to extreme proportions, because if you find something, you need to eat all of it, because it might be the only thing you eat for months. So that, at least for this, was an adaptation I really appreciated them putting on these clingers, because you see, like, you get a hint of it when it first tries to chomp her in the first scene you see the clinger, but then when it really, like, shoves her in, you see its, like, stomach kind of ballooning out and really getting bigger as it's stuffing her in like a snake. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And again, I thought that was, like, well done in terms of a feature that we were running into. Now, in terms of the breeding, and we'll kind of get into this as we go along, because I had a slightly different take than Adam. I think in retrospect, Adam's idea probably works a lot better. But I interpreted when I was watching this as the deep ones being almost like the babies or the children of the Cthulhu creature. But that makes no sense in terms of, because you wouldn't create something that would grow to the same size as you. There wouldn't be enough density of material down there to reproduce in those types of numbers. It wouldn't make sense. And we know there tends to be fairly low levels of life down at the bottom of the Marianas Trench. There are not a lot of organisms. There's no plant material. It's kind of the bottom, the dark area. So you tend to work on sparsity. Most of the animals that exist there have really low metabolic rates.
And if there is life, you might see it clustered around a hydrothermal vent, which Eva brought up in the interview earlier, as she put forward, and I did not know this hypothesis myself, but like one of the hypotheses for the origin of life is at these deep sea hydrothermal vents, where you have these organisms adapted to the heat and the toxic chemicals basically coming out of the mantle of the earth. And they're called extremophiles because they love these extreme conditions. And Jessica Henwick's character mentions them in the movie briefly of like, they mentioned like this life form out there. She's like, well, there can't be unless we hit a hydrothermal vent or something like that. So they touch on that a little bit, which I appreciated again.
Yeah. And we'll sort of get into chemosynthesis as a cool fucking process. So when I had watched it, I was looking at those little tentacle ports, kind of like the simoid frog or the serenomade toad, the species that gives birth out of its skin.
I fucking really hate it.
Yeah, if you have tryptophobia, don't look it up.
Okay, fair enough.
And if you don't know what tryptophobia is, it is the fear of patterns, or like, basically, if any kind of like beaded up, repeated sequence on anything biological disturbs you, you are not going to like it.
It's usually typically with holes or circular.
Yeah, specifically holes. Some people have it so extreme they can't look at like bubbles in a drink, and I don't have it like that, but the Suriname toad disgusts me. I hate looking at it.
I think it's cool.
I'm with Livy. So this is a type of toad species that while having sex, which I always love in frogs and toads, is called amplexus. Which is the idea of where the male is sitting on top of the female and has his hands gripped around her neck.
And he's like squeezing her really in a very rhythmic and directed pattern.
Yeah. So while they're doing this, they actually flip while they're arcing through the water. And basically he releases genetic material that strike 3 to 10 eggs that she releases. And then as she completes her turn, she then locks them into her back, where basically her tissue opens up such to catch these eggs, which is really cool. It's a fantastic juggling during sex act. Really impressive. After implantation, the eggs sink into the skin and they basically form these pockets. And then over the period of several days, they'll eventually take on sort of like this honeycombed appearance, which is absolutely what Adam
is. It's horrendous.
Adam is frowning this entire time.
It's so fucking gross.
The embryos then develop into a tadpole stage in these pockets, eventually emerging from the mother's back. They're sort of less than an inch long, and they kind of climb out, and it's really cool. If you do not have the same freak out that Adam does, and you seem to fall more on the Libyan eye side of the fence here, when they erupt, you get to see these little baby toads, like, crawling out of the mom's skin underwater.
They're not crawling, they're shooting out. It's so gross. It looks like a bunch of little xenomorphs coming out of its back. It's fucking gross.
So when I had first seen this film and rewatching it last night, that's kind of what I was looking at, was the bottom of these tentacles. It looked like almost the babies were climbing out of these little pockets. And I was like, oh, that's why she's so protective of them. Because you can see the suckers on the bottom actually have pockets where these things seem to be retreating into. And that's where they're hanging free from, where you see she pulls one of her tentacles back. She or he, I'm not going to gender Cthulhu. Yeah, so when the behemoth has its tentacled down and they're trying to get into the Roback, whatever the ship is that they, Roback, that it, when its tentacle gets pulled back, you can see all of the creatures actually retreat into the tissue that looks to be on the bottom of the tentacle. Mm. And so it looks like she's providing almost like pocketed tissue. So I had figured that they were trying to create sort of a juvenile link here. The thing is, that makes no sense at all that she would implant them in her skin if she was trying to do a breeding material to protect these. The juveniles don't make sense in terms of like them eventually potentially growing into her size. And they don't really seem to bear a lot of physiological resemblance to her. I mean, from what we get to see, or the colossal one's appearance.
Maybe it's a case where those are males and the behemoth is a female, like an anglerfish, because it is so hard to find a member of your own species. Anglerfish have an adaptation with a sexual dimorphism, so the males and the females look very different. If you see an anglerfish, and the image you think of is a female, they're about the size of a football, so 30 centimeters long or so, fairly bulbous. But the males are much, much smaller, maybe three to five centimeters. And basically what they do is chomp onto the side of a female and fuse with her skin until they become part of her. And the rest of their biological material just kind of disintegrates, and they basically become a pair of gonads on the side of a female. It'd be like if a male human was the size of a female woman's, like a woman's hand, and he like bit onto this woman's thigh and eventually just kind of morphed into her until there was just a pair of testicles hanging off of her leg, and that's what these things
do. Testicles, what every girl wants.
Exactly.
So you're envisioning kind of a combination between an ant colony where you've got this sort of centralized queen who's taking sexual material, and the workers still can move away individually, mixed with some type of anglerfish connection where it's creating almost this parasitic bond where they're kind of sheltering within.
It would also make sense that little one then would be a baby, because if the other ones are juveniles, the deep ones or whatever they are, attached to her, then the other little one that they find in the very beginning would have to be, what, a different species, right?
I don't know, potentially. I think that...
Because they do show some other creatures down there that aren't just related to... I mean, they show that, like, double octopus thing.
They do, the double squid. Mm-hmm. And it's a really weird thing in the movie that, like, makes no sense, and it's just kind of there. But, fun fact, that double squid thing you see, the kind of, like, jump at Kristen Stewart and she's walking by and it scares her, that was the original design for the Klingers. But then they made the Klingers more anthropoid, more human-looking, and I wish they had kept it more tentacle-squiddy.
Right, which would have made way more sense. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the next segue that I wanted to make, which is, their body plan is completely wrong. We don't work great underwater. Despite the wondrous antics of Michael Phelps, we are not great when it comes to movement through the water with our separated limbs. It's not a great body plan.
Same issue with the Gungans.
Right. You're not going to design like that. Now, interesting enough, which I really liked, they don't appear to have bones. They appear to be like an invertebrate species, and you get to see that when Kristen Stewart shoots through the spine, there's no bony material. It's just flesh kind of like sinking up. They've got a format more similar to what we'd expect to see, actually, with something like a jellyfish or one of these other kind of invertebrate organisms that's adapted for life in the bottom
of the ocean. It's probably more like a shark, where it has a cartilaginous skeleton.
Which it definitely could as well. So what it falls into between those two categories, whether or not it's more squid-like or more shark-like, I don't really mind. I thought that was rather cool. There's no way Adam is completely right. They're going to take on a body plan more similar to a squid. If they were existing at this depth, it makes swimming a lot easier. Since vision is so bad in the trench, a lot of these organisms actually rely really heavily on peripheral, palpation. So being able to feel around and kind of like run into different things, and have really heightened senses of smell as well, in terms of their chemoreceptor capabilities, are really good, because you don't have a lot of distance to sort of find your prey. Now, the other big problem, and I don't actually have a great answer to this, is strength. So these things seem to be way too strong.
Incredibly
strong. Like, they grab
strong.
Kristen Stewart, they stuff them into the mouth, and they pull TJ Miller's entire suit apart, the one that was supposed to keep the deep sea out, and actually pull him out of the bottom of his suit.
They pull him in half.
When they just sort of ruptured the one leg. Yeah. Well, you just see his face gets kind of sucked down in the suit, And then suddenly he's gone and there's a whole bunch of blood. And it's unclear if it's implied that they just pulled him out of the suit. But somebody makes that comment later. They're like, they just pulled him out of the suit.
You see the image, like it cuts to after his face getting squished down the helmet. You see an image of like...
just full of blood.
No, not even just that. But you see a brief flash of the suit. Either the leg or the whole bottom half of the suit kind of comes apart a little bit. And you see the blood and the body kind of being pulled through.
Now, really interesting, we don't actually have great measurements of how strong big organisms like the colossal squid are. Which makes sense, right? I mean, anytime we've tried to bring these creatures up to our depth, we kill them. We're not exactly performing interesting experiments at depth. And there appears to be quite a debate between biologists as to whether or not they're going to be fairly strong underwater and be capable of sort of large muscle reactions despite the fact they don't have bone, or whether or not they're going to be in situations where they're going to be quite weak. There doesn't seem to be a good setup. I very much doubt they're going to be able to peel the armor apart, but a lot of the damage that's been done to organisms like sperm whales, where basically it looks like they've been raked by whips, would suggest that these things actually can tear pretty big chunks of flesh off of organisms that seem, in our opinion, to be fairly tough. I don't think they're going to be this strong, but I actually don't have a great answer to how strong would you be if you were just a big organism of flesh and muscle plus or minus cartilage.
It's basically just a giant muscle. That's what most fish tend to be. Like if you've ever held a snake, it is very, very strong. In a cephalopod, like an octopus or a squid, is going to be very similar, where it's just a giant tube of muscle moving around. And I don't know if you've seen the video of the octopus reaching up and grabbing a seagull from the surface, or like dragging a crab under, like, they're fairly strong, and I think that would, at least for these, quote, normal-sized organisms, like a giant squid or a colossal squid, that strength would probably be proportional to their size.
Yeah. So, in terms of strength, maybe not break armor strength, but maybe strong enough to sort of crush them in or squish them, like break a leg, that type of thing. I don't know what the suits are made of. They look intense. And then the last sort of area that I kind of just wanted to briefly talk about... was just the main idea associated with chemosynthesis, which obviously Eva sort of talked about briefly beforehand. So we do have forms of life that survive at the bottom, and they do survive off of the actions from the thermal vents, where they're able to basically produce energy by breaking up normal material. So basically using the nutrients, the inorganic substances, so hydrogen gas, hydrogen sulfide, to create energy-producing material the same way that plants are able to use sunlight to basically change over carbon dioxide, other material, to make glucose strings, where they're able to make artificial sugars to sort of feed themselves and get along. But hydrothermal organisms, and they do tend to be big. We've got examples like the giant tube worm of these organisms that basically lock themselves in near the thermal vents at the bottom and then start to use that as energy sources, but they've got a very regulated body plan. Now, the only way that I could see the colossal one getting as big as it does is if it's potentially just sitting on the largest thermal vent that we've ever discovered.
Yeah.
But if that, and it's not really relying on outside other food processes, it's just been growing for a really long time as the predominant species over top of this thing existing for a very long period. And I do love that we never get to see its legs. For all I know, it's completely just locked in around the thermal vent where it's like shown sort of trying to crawl away. And maybe they did just disturb its position at the bottom of the ocean. You think that they would have had a good geologist that would know that drilling into an area with one of the world's biggest thermal vents is probably not your best idea. Pick a better drilling area. But humans have done some really stupid shit before to try and get oil.
Yes.
Where we have gone into areas that we probably should not. So it's not completely out of the question. The thing is, you wouldn't need arms. You wouldn't need eyes.
Jaws.
You wouldn't need all of these other...
tentacles.
Right, like teeth. Like huge teeth. Huge
eyeballs.
Teeth.
Yeah, eyeballs. You said that.
Right. But that being said, I would not have watched a movie where the top villain at the end of it was just a giant tube worm extending up at the end.
I mean, even then, if it was, we see no evidence of there being a giant hydrothermal vent. Jessica Henwick just mentions it offhand, and maybe
no,
there
it's
is.
True.
Even if there was, those organisms are colonial. It's not, well, they exist in colonies. So it's not a colonial organism. You don't have a massive, they don't grow in proportion to how big the vent is. It's just you have more of them around a bigger vent. It's like flowers around in a field.
So I guess the bits that I wanted to bring back and sort of get Libby's opinion here are, there was lots throughout this movie where I was like, you know what? The deep ones should not look like they do. They should be sort of the squid appearance with these kind of eyes. The deep one or the colossal one should look very different in terms of its formation, its like body structure, its body plan, anything like that. However, from a movie picture, if I was designing this or making this type of movie to try and get audiences to watch it, I kind of really like the way they look. I thought they were creepy and off-putting and scary, and the Cthulhu reveal at the end, I kind of really enjoyed. I don't know, Libby, if you felt there was anything that you would have been like, eh, you could have changed this and still gotten like a scene. Like if they gave the deep ones more of a traditional, almost mermaid body at the bottom, kind of a fish and a fin that would kind of help them to move better, or whether or not you felt the look of them that we get to see in terms of the pieces was well done enough.
Yeah, I think for me, I liked part of them. I liked the part that were squid based. I thought that that was okay. Really neat. I was not a fan of the humanoid side of things. I feel like that really took me out of it. Because anytime you have these, you know, wondrous sort of intangible creatures, to make it look like a human just really lacks something for me. It just feels lazy. So they just kind of look like underwater Slendermen some of the time. Which took me out of it.
Good comparison.
But I really liked when they looked more like squid. So like that scene where she's like walking through and they're all like kind of hanging down, like the tentacles are swaying. Mm-hmm. That was awesome. That was super creepy. You know, you didn't know what was going to jump out at you, what was going to curl around you like a snake. But I'm a little less scared of, you know, grabby hands, human hands.
So if they had taken the juvenile that they run into when they're trying to get the escape pod that has the tentacles coming off it, but still has the traditional head, it's just kind of like pushed in and the eyes are kind of weird and shrunken, but just made a bigger version of that with kind of that still scary head that reflects the light and the teeth, but it's just moving around with more of a tentacled lower body and kind of pieces of it that you can't make out the whole organism. That would have been more in Libby's design of, ooh, that's way scarier.
Yes.
Yeah, I can definitely get behind that. I think I would have been more terrified, because you're right. The more I think about it, it is a little bit of a lazy shift over to just simply be like, oh, this is fine. We'll just make it look like a big human underwater with webbed fingers.
A human being.
It wasn't scary at all. Like, it's like I was saying earlier, another reason this didn't feel anything like Lovecraftian horror. It barely even felt like a threatening monster. It was more of a threat of being at the bottom of the ocean where the pressure and temperature, we should mention, that water is just above freezing. So they would have all been freezing to death in that water, the humans at least. But none of it was threatening. It wasn't scary. Some of the scenes were really cool, but it's not like Alien where you have this very disturbing, very scary looking creature that you don't really get a glimpse of until the very end of the movie. But these, it's like, okay, you have like a tall, creepy looking bald dude, but it's not intimidating. Like, One of the creatures you see in the Dunwich Horror, H.P. Lovecraft story, is this person who is like, he's half demon, half person, because he's the product of a elder god breeding with a human. But his legs are like satyr's legs. They're covered in fur. They have hooved feet. He has like, he's really, really tall. But he also has like eyeballs on his hips. He's got a weird bunch of tentacles kind of coming out of his stomach.
It's just his stomach.
Yeah. Just, and like, but also like kind of to the sides, so, like, it's not symmetrical, it doesn't make sense, it's very difficult to look at, it's very disturbing. These are just weird looking, they weren't disturbing to look at, it was nothing to me.
Yeah, I think that's a good point of like that Lovecraftian horror is just that, a horror. Like when you look at it, it is
unknowable,
it is disturbing to see. Mm-hmm. And these creatures were definitely cool, but they did not disturb me.
Yeah.
Now, as a little side point that I enjoyed rewatching this film last night, H.P. Lovecraft drew a sketch of what he thought Cthulhu would look like, included it in The Call of Cthulhu, and I hadn't realized it's in the captain's locker where she ends up in like the area where she gets, Kristen Stewart gets the souped up armor, and that he's got that like taped down. I thought that was cool. I thought that was rather cool when I watched that.
Yeah, I think in reference to the captain's locker that there might have been a version of this movie or like deleted scenes whereby this was a more Lovecraftian movie, because in the captain's locker, you see this, like, a stereotypical crazy person's map with all these lines connecting these points and question marks and little notes. And it's, as like, all these lines lead to the Roebuck, where we find the behemoth at the very end of the movie. And the captain is hinted to have kind of not be that mentally stable when they're asking about his daughter, and who's he's been lying about being dead, and she died when she was 14. So maybe there's something there of the captain knew about this or was influenced by it, and that changed his actions and led the crew to find this thing and then eventually dig up the behemoth. Hmm. And that would have been much more in line with Lovecraftian horror, but this version was not.
Oh my god, dude, I'm freaking out. I am so stressed out. I feel like I'm having a panic attack.
You want to talk about stress? You want to talk about stress? Okay? I've stumbled onto a major company conspiracy, Mac. How about that for stress?
What the hell are you talking about? This company is being bled like a stuffed pig, Mac, and I got a paper trail to prove it. Check this out. Take a look at this.
Jesus Christ,
Charlie. That right there is the mail. Now let's talk about the mail. Can we talk about the mail, please, Mac? I'm dying to talk about the mail with you all day, okay?
Moving on to just some sort of general movie notes about this, because I love this enough that I started kind of reading into it. So the first time my partner and I watched it, she was like, oh God, like Kristen Stewart immediately gets into her underwear kind of as this film goes on. And like, was that necessary? And there are a couple of butt shots that I feel were completely unnecessary in terms of the level the camera went to.
One of them was on TJ Miller, which was refreshing.
Which was, yes, his ripped underwear, which I got a laugh out of. And my partner pointed that out as we were watching as well. She's like, we do get to see some butt shots from the various male actors as well. It's just they're not as predominant. But apparently, when Kristen Stewart was signing up for this, she'd said that one of the things that had caught her with this film is the fact that it starts right away. And it literally starts with her brushing her teeth. And she'd said that she wanted a horror movie that kind of fed into the idea that you can go anywhere. And that, you know, you could just be brushing your teeth, or she's like, she wanted to sell the image that, like, you could be standing in the shower, or you could be, you know, fast asleep. And even when she arrives and she's talking to the captain, and she's like, well, I found a body back there. It's actually from the woman who, like, has the apartment, like, right next to me. I'd gone downstairs to, like, brush my teeth. That could have been me. That could have been me. That could have been me, before the captain, like, calms her down. He's like, think forward, not backward.
Mm-hmm. But in a French accent.
But, yes. Yeah, in a much better accent. And I liked that basically, and she said that one of the other reasons that she like loved the underwear and the look was apparently because she hated being inside of the suits. So they built these giant suits for the movie, and to try and get the movement and everything correct, they wanted to put these things underwater. And she said they were hot. They were claustrophobic. Apparently they weighed a ton underwater trying to move around in these things and try to make it look realistic. And she said the scariest thing was they would go down at 15 minutes at a time, but if anything went wrong, you'd have to like try to like communicate with the group at the top where they had like rescue divers that were waiting. But there was a major delay happening with the audio and it didn't work well. So there were a number of times where the actors were like trying to communicate or trying to say something like, you know, I'm freaking out inside this suit that you've got me in the bottom of this built set that you're using for the underwater thing. You need to get me the fuck out of here. And the only response they would get back from, like, the rescue divers at the top was like, what? And she was like, fuck, like, you're already, like, freaking out, and now you're trying to, like, calm yourself down enough to be like, listen, motherfucker, you need to get me the fuck out of here right now. And so she said, being hot and inside of these things, she was like, I was totally fine with underwear. She's like, sports bra and underwear, she's like, you know, sweatpants would have got wet, and she's like, I wanted it to be realistic. And she's like, I felt a lot more comfortable getting inside of these big, scary suits, knowing that I didn't also have all this other wet clothing that was going to get bogged down every time I got in and out of this damn thing. Which I was like, okay, I'm down for that. Basically, her saying, I'd feel more comfortable getting inside this in my equivalent of a bathing suit.
And they bring that point up in the movie where they're first getting into them, of Jessica Henwick's character, she's just wearing her clothes. Kristen Stewart's like, take your pants off. They're not going to fit. And it makes sense, because if you have this kind of suit, you're not going to design it so people can wear a ton of clothing when they're in it. It's going to fit very close to your skin, so the most you can wear is maybe a bodysuit, like a wetsuit, but beyond that...
Or a fanny pack with a rabbit in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Or stuff in your little chest piece.
And she said the last thing was, not only was it kind of like 15 minutes that they were sort of at the bottom and like they were down there, but it also took 15 minutes, they said, to get the actors in and out of these suits. So she said there were some heavy claustrophobic moments where like you'd get brought up to the surface, you'd like have someone who was trying to like get you out of this thing, and you'd have to calm yourself down for 15 minutes while they slowly like undid all the latches and kind of got you out of this thing. So she's like, I wanted to be as comfortable as physically possible while I was in that situation.
And those suits weighed 100 pounds or about 45 kilograms. They were massively heavy.
I feel
and bulky.
Like Jessica, what's her last name?
Jessica Henwick.
Jessica Henwick weighs, what, like 105 pounds?
Maybe.
Yeah. So they said there were some practical elements of this that were unideal, and I am a human that really gets claustrophobic really easily. I was not claustrophobic watching this movie, but reading through her interviews talking about being trapped in this little suit definitely caused me to like stop reading a couple of minutes and go for like a walk around my apartment before I'd be like, oh.
Stretching his arms out.
I'm free. Yeah, like I have space. I'm okay. Yeah, and then I guess the only sort of last things, and we briefly touched on this, and I kind of wanted to get into this. So when the creatures are rushing up towards the escape pods, and Adam had already brought this up, they're going to die. They're going to decompress. They're going to explode. Like when they're in these big iron suits and they're worried about spontaneous decompression, the creatures should also be very worried about this, going up and down at those points. But also, the escape pods can't shoot straight to the surface. We've briefly talked about decompression sickness before and the bends.
The bend is a very, very real threat.
Right. You've got to go up in levels. Otherwise, you're going to start to get the dissolved gases in your blood are going to start to literally come out. They're going to boil the blood and you're going to start to get free gases present in your tissues, which apparently is one of the most painful conditions imaginable as it like invades your joints, your tissue, everything starts to spasm. You oftentimes experience seizures. Death is a really high risk.
Yeah, it's not a, it's one of those things, even within a relatively shallow body of water, like 20 meters, 60 feet, something like that, you still have to take some time and go up in stages or else these gases build up in your blood and will kill you.
Inside, the four men have just been subjected to incredible force. The air would be forced from their lungs violently, causing substantial damage. The reduced pressure causes ebullism, formation of gas bubbles in the body, which results in tissue damage. In explosive decompression, great force is exerted out of the leak in the vessel. But inside the chamber, everything is rushing towards the hole.
Overall, in terms of the film, I agree with you guys. I would have liked it if the creatures were a little bit more creepy looking, if they'd done a better job of kind of like separating the monsters. But I loved the environment. I loved the good humans.
Mm-hmm.
No one was trying to screw each other over. Everybody kept trying to be the one who like steps in to like mm-hmm. take the hit, or the one who knows that like they're not going to make it out of there. It's a really good look at humanity as a whole. And as much as I didn't love it because it doesn't feed into Adam's idea of the cosmic horror, I loved Kristen Stewart giving the finger to Cthulhu at the end and then exploding the entire ship. Man, that was a great scene.
Yeah, I'll say this too for it. While there are still some things to change as far as sexism and versus feminism in this movie, I think it takes good steps in the right direction of having female characters that are not only believable but capable and not placated to, whether that be in the story or to the audience.
And I would recommend this movie, Dave and Lippy.
Yeah. Oh, it's a fun couch watch for sure.
I would definitely recommend this movie. And then to fill in for Sam's point that he wanted to add for these types of movies, did anyone at any moment feel bad for the monster?
You gotta say that in an Australian accent, though.
Right. Did anybody feel bad for the monster?
Nah.
Nah, he's a cunt.
Not once.
No.
No. No. I was quite happy to see it imploded at the end, and I think I really enjoyed as well that the movie ends with like the corporation denying everybody access, yep. and they have the picture of them like measuring the bunny and everything, and then it's just that final scene of plans to start re-digging again in the next 8 months, and I was like, nice. Because you know BP would definitely go back.
Oh, they absolutely. Would. Absolutely.
They would. The name of the company, Tien, is Mandarin for gate. So that's, no, sorry, sky. Sky. So that's pretty interesting that this deep, deep, deep water mining company is named after the sky. That's fun.
Hmm.
So yeah, I don't really have any extra points. I don't know, Adam or Libby, if you guys wanted to add anything else in.
I have nothing to add, but next week we'll be coming back with another special guest, Dr. I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name, but Dr. Kirsty MacLeod, who is going to be joining us the movie Annihilation, which actually mm-hmm. is cosmic horror.
I'm
very excited about this.
I'm so excited.
I have not seen it yet, so.
Oh, we're rewatching. My partner and I are going to rewatch it this week, and I will say this movie always scares the shit out of me.
It's so good.
The final scene, which we'll get into next week, just causes me to like freak my skin, and I'm awake for like days after it. I'm so excited. All right. Well, Adam, do you want to sign us off?
Yeah. As we say here every week, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
On a scale from 1 to 10, how bad's my rig?
10.
Gotta get to the station.
How will we even get there?
We walk. We're just gonna walk with insufficient oxygen across the bottom of the ocean.
You don't know what's out there.
Worst idea ever!
What was that?
Turn your lights off.